When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. I got to start with probably the funniest story I saw all day. And look, you know, if I'm being accused of a crime, if I've been indicted, maybe I try this tact. But according to the AP, Donald Trump's lawyers have asked a federal judge to schedule trial for April of 2026. April of 2026. Now, look, you know, I'm going. Who knows? He may not even be alive in 2026. But the DOJ is asking for a January, this coming January, a couple months down the road. The Trump folks, 2026. Yeah. And look, am I surprised? No, not at all. But what they're saying is, look, you know, sorry, you know, the guy's, he's a busy guy. He's a busy guy. He's got stuff. He's got places to be, things to do, people to see, deals to make. Because he's got to surround himself with the best people. I'm guessing that's it. Now, the argument is he's running for president, so we don't want to interfere with that. So I guess if I'm ever accused of a crime, I'm just going to run for something. Run, instead of running, just run for office. Because, hey, you know, you're disrupting my schedule. Quite amazing, amazing stuff. Now, yesterday I talked about something that evidently, you know, piqued some interest in some, angered some others. I talked about the song North, Rich Man North of Richmond, I guess it's what it's called, by this guy Oliver Arnold, I believe his name is, or Oliver Anthony. Yes. I said I listened to it. I saw that it was getting some attention, and the listservs that I'm on, you know, the people who I are much further left politically than I am, basically calling it a Nazi anthem. You know, it's the song of white supremacists, and he's going after, everyone saw what they wanted to see in it. Whatever their colored glasses were, that's what they saw. Whatever silo they found themselves, that's what they saw. And I was simply pointing out that, look, the reality in this day and age is people are angry, people are struggling, people are suffering, things are happening that need to be addressed. And that we do need to listen to others. We do need to hear the voices of working people. And look, first and foremost, I am not a country music fan by any stretch of the imagination. My wife will attest to that. You know, we've been together a long time. Been married over 23 years now. Been together, you know, 27 some odd years. Never. In fact, one of the first things that came up was, what kind of music do you like? Anything but country was the response. And, well, here we've been together all this time. But here's the thing. Not a fan. Just to put that on the table. Not a fan. Had to do that. But the idea behind it, I'm a supporter of. The idea of working people are struggling, I'm a huge supporter of. So I got a bunch of emails, and I want to go through some of it. Daryl from Minneapolis wrote me an email, said, Rick, you read the lyrics to Rich Man North of Richmond, and I have to tell you, I was so happy to hear your take. Too often we are forced into silos and never actually talk about anything productive. I think you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about Red Hat, Blue Hat. Love that frame, by the way. I saw LeBron James singing along to that song and thought, LeBron James and Rick Smith like it? It must be all right. Keep up the fight, brother. And look, Daryl, again, not a country music fan. It's the message, and it's what's being sent out. It's what we should be hearing. You know, the feeling of this country right now is there's something wrong. People are angry, and we have to address this. And I've said for a very long time, whichever party figures out how to address these concerns and make people feel like they're addressing their needs, they're going to be the dominant party. I think of FDR. You know, people are still talking about, we need to go back to the New Deal and FDR. There needs to be that. Because understand, you watch some of the videos that come out of these rallies and stuff. There are people who are angry. They're saying, we're not Democrats or Republicans. This isn't white or black. This is what I've always said. It's green. It's money. And what the reality is, and the reason we keep hearing a lot of the stuff that we hear, is once we figure out corporate America has been screwing us, they're in trouble. Once the very wealthy are the target instead of each of us, there's going to be problems. Now, I got another email, no name. Rick, I'm disappointed to hear you defending that Richmond song. You know what people like me means, right? This is dog whistle to white supremacist crowd. Do better, Rick. I didn't get that. I guess maybe you can throw that in there somewhere if that's what your view is, what your silo is. I get it. But then I got these emails. Now understand, I know nothing about Oliver Anthony. All I saw was this song being talked about in this space that I ghost, that I just want to know what people are saying. And this is horrible. This is bad. So I had to go see it. So this person sends me an email, and I'm assuming this photo is of a Facebook post from Oliver Anthony. And on February 24th, 2022, he posts, "As an American, I support and stand with Joe Biden. He has changed this country for the better. Those who live off government assistance are parasites to this country. Joe is what a true American is, hardworking and not taking handouts. Those on the right who sit on their backsides and complain about the left are not this country. A true Democrat is this country, and that is Joe." This is the guy who supposedly wrote the white nationalist anthem. Someone else sent me an actual Facebook post, a link to his Facebook page, where he goes through and tells the story of his life. He talks about how he dropped out of high school in 2010 and then got a GED. He talks about working in multiple plants for poverty wages, 6 days a week, third shift. He talks about the struggle. He talks about being injured on the job in 2013, fracturing his skull and can't work for months. He talks about all of this stuff. And this is not unique. This is what working people go through and what I've been talking about for years now. This should be new to none of my listeners. This is the kind of stuff that I've been talking about for, well, coming up on 18 years now. Because this is the life that working people live. He said he got another job where he spent the last 10 years hearing the same story from person after person. And he says, look, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of people being neglected, divided, and manipulated. He said, look, there's nothing special about me. I'm not a very good musician. Not a very good person. He says, spent the last 5 years struggling with mental health, using alcohol to drown it out. He just says, look, I just want to see a better country. And I got to tell you, when I listened to that song, that is what I heard. And what I hoped would come out of it is what he says he wants. And that is people to pay attention to who is really dividing us. Look, and you could attack me. I've been attacked over this before. As someone who was humiliated having to use food stamps as a kid because my mother could not find employment or childcare or any of that, I am dead set against handout programs. I want jobs programs. My mother wanted a job. My mother needed healthcare. I want policies that are going to move in this direction so that we don't have these humiliation moments. We don't have these divisive moments. And I've said for years, government should be the employer of last resort, bottom line. You need a job, you need to put food on the table, you're going to get one. But no, we're not going to get that from our Republican friends. And again, I come back to, saw this information today. CEOs from 300 of the healthcare companies in this country, the top 300 CEOs of publicly traded healthcare. Now remember, we're told, well, healthcare is all nonprofit. Nonsense. Their combined salary in 2022 was $4 billion. $4 billion over 300 people. You're talking over $13 million a person here, with the top guy being, or the top actually woman, being the head of Moderna, pocketing $394 million. You want to be mad at something? Be mad at that person. Be mad at this system. Now look, the welfare person who he went after eating the fudge rounds, yeah, you go, hey, I don't agree with that. The welfare queen that I want to go after, the parasite that I want us to go after, are these CEOs who are stealing healthcare dollars that should be taking care of people instead of lining their pockets. See, I'm a policy person, always have been. Sound policy, smart investment. That's how we rebuild the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And I come back to where this has to be political. The Republican Party has shown me nothing that they give a rat's behind about any working person. What policy have they moved forth that's going to help us? Let's take school lunches, for example. Something very simple, something that benefits the working class of this country, something that I benefited from as a child. They want to do away with universal lunch programs. It's in the Republican Study Committee's report. Want to do away with that. Kids, if they're hungry, they'll go in and clean the bathroom, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. You just had Josh Shapiro, who's just signed the law here in Pennsylvania guaranteeing breakfast and lunch for students in this state. That is a good thing. Republicans want means testing of lunch programs because, you know, we don't want anyone undeserving to eat. And I like what Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said. He said, look, the haves and the have-nots in the school lunchroom is not necessarily the thing. Just feed our children. Give them the dignity of just being able to eat. In the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, can we at least do that? And then maybe we start. We're reaching out to this Oliver Anthony to try and get him on the show because I think this guy can be helpful. Because someone like this can, in fact, go into those crowds and talk about the things that he's written, the things that we talk about here on this show. It's possible. We just have to do it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I'm still stuck on the Trump lawyers going, yeah, we'll start trial. Let's book April of 2026. Let's do that. Wow. I don't know how you do that with a straight face. I don't. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I wanted to talk about the connections between, say, for instance, country music as an art form. And what you were referring to in terms of what position it has in terms of our culture and in terms of the working class movement, I would argue that more so than any other musical form, it has ties to the working class movement in a way that no other form does. And for generations, you know, these were the artists that were singing about the plight of the working man. And what they owed to the system, and how they couldn't get ahead, and how you get paid and go back and give it all to the company store, this was the kind of art form that helped to bring many of these people to unions and bought them to the Democratic Party. But as union strength has eroded, and union membership has declined, the Republicans have been successfully able to peel these people off. Based on a number of different tactics, not the least of which are things like social issues, single voter issues like abortion and gun rights and so forth. And because let's face it, these individuals who are from the old Rust Belt and part of the South, they were never voting Democrat because of our positions on race, on gender, on sexual orientation. None of these things. You know, as a matter of fact, they would hold their nose on those issues and vote for us. In many ways. So when they no longer saw themselves as being represented by the Democrats, because again, the unions were no longer serving the same role that they did, say in 1970 in this country, then they felt they had no allegiance to the Democratic Party, and it allowed the Republican Party to peel them away. So and you're absolutely correct. The question is, how do we get them back to realizing that their interest lies in the same camp as other people who may not look like them? They might not go to the same church, they might not be the same skin color, they might not be of the same ethnic origin, but nonetheless they are all in the same pot when it comes to being part of the working class or working poor in this country, or even the middle class. And yet somehow Republicans have convinced them that they have more in common with a CEO than they do with some guy who is a different color or ethnicity who lives across the street from them.
No, you're spot on. And this is the mastery of what Republicans have done. And I got to tell you, the failure of the Democratic Party to give them a reason. And you're spot on right. And I go back to the Clinton era. You know, as people were losing their factory jobs, this, hey, just go get an education, that doesn't fly. Because, you know, what are you going to do with somebody in their 50s who had a job making 70, 80 grand a year? Now you're going to train them to go back to almost minimum wage? That's a slap in the face.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not sure how we get them back in light of a global economic dynamic. I don't want to go too deep in the woods with this, but I contend that part of what we came to realize was the American dream coming out of the Great Depression and really going to, say, about the mid-1970s, early 1980s. You had a couple of generations of what we identify today as the American dream. You could come out of high school, mediocre education, go to work in a steel plant here in on the south side of Chicago, as my father did, and raise four children. You could send them to college, you could retire. But that was a dream that lasted a couple of generations until it started to fade. And largely because, you know, after coming out of the Second World War, the United States produced 51% of all the goods and services on the planet. So I want people to understand and to get a perspective of what that meant in 1945.
Right.
And then to go forward, obviously that declined over time, and the people that they saw their industries decimated in Europe, Japan saw its industry decimated. Well, over the next 30 years, they rebuilt their industries to modern standards. We in America, we didn't. Instead, corporate America here, the big three in Detroit, thought that they would reign supreme for centuries to come in the auto industry and could build junk and pocket money because they thought everybody was going to buy American until the end of time. Well, that didn't happen because other car manufacturers built better things and cars that people actually wanted, and they came to realize that a bit too late. So I don't know what the answer is, because, again, we're living in a global economy, and now no matter who you are, with the exception of a few industries, you have to compete in an international marketplace. And how do we then do that?
Well, I think what Biden is doing with, you know, some of the policies to reshore manufacturing and government investment in new technology, I think that's a smart first step. It's going to help us build an industrial base that's going to move us in that direction. And I understand what you're saying, that, the globe was void of a lot of manufacturing, but we're also the planet's largest consumer. So if my ideal of domestic production for domestic consumption, I think you start there.
Oh, and you're absolutely right. Now, obviously, the plan in terms of what you're talking about is very different than what you see manifested in the real world economy. In the real world economy, CEOs and division heads and so forth, they all are under pressure to minimize costs,
yep.
Which, let's face it, the single largest cost is labor. So in other words, if we could automate, if we could offshore, if we could do any of these things to minimize costs, then obviously we can maximize profits. The problem is, but if you spread that out over the entire economy, because you're not the only one to think of this, you know, that sooner or later you run out of people who you want to sell things to because they no longer have jobs and therefore cannot buy the things you're selling. The way in which, you know, things worked for much of the 20th century was American workers made a good living and bought a lot of things with the money that they made.
Yep.
And all of us prospered under that system. But what happens when you don't need workers anymore, or you need them at such a minimum rate of pay, such that, you know, and then you expand that over the entire economy. Okay, who's buying what you're selling now?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I couldn't have said it better myself. Good stuff, Steve. I mean, I'm right there with you. I mean, the idea that if workers don't have wages, and this is what I fear about automation and robotics. You know, when people are no longer needed, who buys the widgets and the whatnots? You're right. Appreciate
Absolutely.
The call, man.
If I could make this one last point, I do think there is an additional conundrum here in that, you know, the quote-unquote American dream, if the entire world lived like the average American lives, we would need 2 to 3 additional planet Earth. So we do have to start asking ourselves, you know, even if we could go back to our grandfather's day of consumption in terms of where America stood versus the rest of the world, we don't have the resources on this planet for everybody to live the way that we used to. Not because the rest of the world didn't stand still. They came out of poverty, including in China and India and so forth. So how do we then reconcile that?
It's a good question. I'm sure you've got an answer for that real quick?
I have no answer for that because, again, where do you get those resources?
I'm with you. I got to move on. I got to get one more call before the break. I appreciate the call, Steve, though. Thanks so much. Let's go to Alice real quick. Got a minute for you, Alice. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to say was, I think one of the factors that has led to the working class going over to the Republican Party is, in the heyday of the Democratic Party, they were just coming out of the Depression and World War II. And a lot of families had been through extreme poverty and saw that the Republican Party wasn't worried about it. But the Democrats, FDR, et cetera, were trying to make things better. And I think as we hit the 60s and then we went through the, you know, let's get rid of the racism and all this kind of stuff, things kind of switched and the Republicans used their multi-prong attack to take over. That's my theory.
No, it is. And you know, as corporate America was leaving the shores and shedding workers and saying, screw you guys, you're on your own, and pocketing massive amounts of profit, they left people behind. And that's where I come back to this song and the feeling that this guy's got, that, you know, it's a struggle. And it's not just him. It's a lot of working people. There's a lot of working class angst out there. But I appreciate the call, Alice. Thank you. Seriously, I mean, I'm curious how you see this. And please email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, even if you disagree with me. Because I think someone has to break this divide. We've been going into places and talking to people for years about just this, about making lives better. So my true north is always, how do we make working people's lives better? How do we make sure that people can afford a roof over their head and food on the table so that that kid growing up in the housing project that I grew up in at least has the same opportunities that I had and doesn't have to endure the same kind of humiliation and the same kind of nonsense that I had to go through. We can make people's lives better. Isn't that what we should be striving for? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're celebrating the one-year anniversary of the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act. If you look at some of the numbers, it's there's truth in advertising. Inflation has come down. Jobs are being created. We're in the middle of what it could be an energy boom, a clean energy boom. And it has everything to do with the fact that Biden was able to get that Inflation Reduction Act passed. Something that I had numerous people tell me, and I got to be honest, I was one of them thinking, never going to happen. I never thought Manchin or Sinema or any of them would come along, but got it done, and things are happening. Jobs are being created. Communities are getting better. Good stuff. And here to share some thoughts on just how good, I've asked Cynthia Finney to come talk with us. She's the president of the Maine AFL-CIO. You can check out their website, maineaflcio.org. Cynthia, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the one-year anniversary, and I'm going, you know, how fast can you get the money out the door? How fast can these projects ramp up? You know, what's going on in Maine? What projects are you seeing? What's going on?
Well, you pass a bill and you want everything to happen right away, but then there's the rulemaking and all of that. But it's coming, and one of the things that has happened right away is that the labor standards in those bills, in that bill, has allowed us in our work to build out offshore wind as we look at trying to do Maine's part in fending off climate change. Because of the standards in that bill, we were able to get an offshore wind bill for Maine that's going to ensure that as we build these jobs in the clean energy climate that you've just talked about, the clean energy economy, that those are good jobs that have good wages and good benefits. And it was the Inflation Reduction Act provisions that allowed us to assure people that we could set high standards for how big the projects were going to be and how soon we're going to be able to do them in our offshore wind bill that we passed in the state legislature.
Yeah, what I love is they kept Davis-Bacon in there. Republicans tried to get it ripped out. They were able to keep it in there. Also, you know, just recently, and I'm sure you know this as well as anyone, the president came out and said we're going back to the pre-Reagan era, ideal of Davis-Bacon, which means more good jobs for more workers and better opportunities for communities. So for a state like Maine, that I got to tell you, last time I was there, almost blew me off the shore. Lots of wind energy projects have got to be coming up and down your shore.
Yeah, offshore wind is going to be a big thing. And of course, in Maine, you know, if you were here, especially if you were here as a tourist, you know about the importance of the lobster industry. And so we were really pleased to be able to put together a coalition and include in our offshore wind bill protection for the Lobster Management Area 1, which is one of the primary fishing areas for that, to preserve the culture, the history, and the economy that goes along with that. So again, really strong bill that we're proud of to be making those changes. Now, and those Davis-Bacon provisions that you mentioned that are going to create, high standards, so the bidders have to actually create jobs with good wages and good benefits. They can't just come in as the low bidder and rake off the profits from this. You know, it's our tax money. We want it spent to create something that's going to benefit the whole community.
Absolutely. You know, I've been saying for the longest time on this issue in particular, is that, you know, if we're using our tax dollars to get the things that we need, it should benefit the community in more ways than just getting the cheap thing. But, you know, yeah. There's this moment where I look at Joe Biden and I go, you know, he is, in his words, the most pro-union president in my lifetime. And I agree. And this is one of those examples. And the fact, I can't emphasize this enough, that it was put in the Inflation Reduction Act and in the infrastructure bill and mandated to be part of that, so that those jobs would be created and those would be good jobs, so that competition would happen on quality, on getting things done, on efficiency, and not on who's willing to work for pennies. That to me is the most important part of it.
Exactly. And it's huge, and it goes way further than anything I can remember in terms of federal support that way, which again allows us to then create those standards here in the state. And I can tell you, if you want, I could share a couple of stories of some of the exciting things, you know, individuals that this is.
No, I was just going to ask you, you know, tell me what's going on, what's happening on the ground.
So in anticipation of these clean energy jobs that are being created and also the construction jobs from the infrastructure bill, we're fast-tracking folks into the union apprenticeships to build out those workforces. And we have a pre-apprenticeship program where we're specifically seeking to bring folks who might not find their way to these good jobs on their own and support them into a solid union apprenticeship. So, for example, we've just graduated our second class. We have this one fella, young guy, grew up in poverty, kind of in and out of the justice system as a young person. He worked a lot of what were, in his words, lousy jobs. He felt taken advantage of, felt unvalued. So for a person like him, he's going to have a job now in an organization where they say, you matter, your life matters, or he's going to be getting paid wages that he can live and build a future on. You know, that's one example. We have another young woman who she was in the reentry program coming out of the Maine justice system, and she's going to be starting on Monday. She's got a job lined up. She's going to be going to a job that's going to support her. It's not just going to give her pennies and have her scrambling for assistance elsewhere. It's a job that's going to support her. And through her union benefit program, she's going to have a recovery program built into the benefits that's going to support her through her transition back from the justice system and, you know, the bad breaks that took her there and the hard times she's had, and give her a future. And we're pretty excited about that, and so is she.
Yeah, no, look,
and those things are possible because of those standards. So those contractors can bid on those jobs and have a hope of winning them.
Yeah, you know, I've been talking about, you know, telling those stories, oh, I don't know, for all 18 years of doing this show, because I think those are important. You know, when I tell my story about, you know, growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland and seeing that neighbor get that union job as a young kid and seeing their lives get better immediately, so that, you know, at a young age, you get that idea of union job, better life. I've been saying for the longest
Absolutely.
Time that needs to happen. And the Department of Labor right now, and I'm sure you know this, they've just launched the Apprentice Trailblazer Initiative to do just what you're saying. Tell those stories, share those stories with people so that you get more people to come to the trades. Because I don't know if you know this, but we're going to need more tradespeople.
We're going to be building a lot of green energy. We're going to be retrofitting buildings, really, really making a shift.
And this, for me, is the way we rebuild our economy in a way that supports
exactly.
a strong middle class, a strong working class, a prosperous working class. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier here in the program about, you know, how do we recreate that era that our grandparents grew up in? And I think, you know, ensuring that these jobs that are going to rebuild our country is the basis for this. And then we build out from there. But for me, these construction jobs, these should be the gold standard that everybody wants to be part of.
Absolutely. The tax incentives in these bills, both the Inflation Reduction Act and our offshore wind bill here in Maine, the tax incentives are really significant to lead people to the high road when they're bidding on these projects.
So what kind of projects are happening in Maine? I know the wind, there's a lot of wind happening. Anything else going on in your state?
There's a lot of solar being built, and some of that started before we got rolling on these projects. So some of those jobs are not so good, but some of them are good and increasingly union, and we're aiming to trend them that way so that they support people and don't just use people. So lots of solar being built. We're leading an initiative through the Maine Labor Climate Council toward public buildings, schools in particular, for a retrofit for better energy for better air. You know, it'll make a cleaner environment for people to work in. It'll use less energy. It'll save the district's money. So that's going to be really exciting. That project is in its infancy, but we're hoping that that's really going to take off and transform a lot of our public buildings into energy savers instead of expensive energy costs for town districts.
So what you're saying, what you're telling me is you're indoctrinating the children to like green energy.
We're hoping to convince the school boards as well, yes.
No, at the
and
end
yes,
of the day,
if children grow up with that, they're going to like it. It's going to be a good memory.
No, no. Look, we put solar panels on our house back in 12. And it's one of those things that my kids saw. And they started then questioning, you know, why doesn't our school have it? And then a couple years later, our school district put in a big array. And they were asking, you know, why doesn't the Walmart and the shopping mall and, you know, all this open, why don't we have solar panels everywhere, Dad? And I'm going, well, we just don't have the will yet. And maybe we will. Maybe this is going to move us in that direction.
Yeah, certainly some will was created to pass that bill because it wasn't easy. As you know, if you followed all the iterations it had to go through to finally come out and become real. But it takes people like your son asking those questions.
But, you know, here's the thing. And I go, you know, this is it's historic. It's moving us in a positive direction, but it's not enough. I mean, you know, and I know I sound greedy. I know I sound, you know, like I'm whining. But if we're going to truly transform this country for the future and give our children and grandchildren a country worth inheriting, I think we got to move a little quicker. We got to get a little step in the giddy up.
Yeah, well, you know, 4 years ago, Governor Mills said Maine won't wait when she talked about our climate plan. And again, you know, that's one of the things we're excited about in this offshore wind bill, because we were able to make it a lot bigger than it was going to be and with a much more ambitious timeline because of the conditions that were set by the Inflation Reduction Act. And you're right, it is just one of the things, but we have to do all of the things. And this was a really important one that we're really proud to be moving forward on, as well as the other things, programs that we've talked about.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Cynthia Finney. She's the president of the Maine AFL-CIO. You can check out their website, maineaflcio.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, the Inflation Reduction Act is a lot more than just the clean energy stuff. You know, prescription drugs, some talk about that, insulin. There's a bunch of things in there to try and bring costs down. And I know a state like Maine, an older state, state that, you know, has some of these. How is this helping bring your inflation down? Because I look at Florida. Florida's going crazy with inflation. I don't know what they're doing down there, but wow. How are things going in Maine?
The numbers, but I do know that it's making a difference when people are making enough money to be able to afford things. I know things are leveling out. And I also know another thing that's in the bill is equity standards on some of this work, so that when contractors are providing jobs for folks who haven't traditionally been able to have them, and, you know, again, you know, a personal story, because that's where it's real. It's when it happens to a real person, is another one of these folks who came through our construction academy. He's from a Sudanese refugee family, grew up in the south of the United States, and I don't know how he ended up in Maine, but here he is. And he came through our pre-apprenticeship program. He's got just a strong sense of racial justice, and he's really excited to be working as an electrician in green energy. And those standards for equity provide additional, besides the benefits for if you follow the labor standards, then there's additional benefits that are available to contractors who also have diverse workforces and things like that. So we're also creating that kind of change in our society and really building at the same time that we're building an economy that can support the climate and the planet. We're also building an economy that can get rid of the inequality, which I'm sure you've talked about many times on your show over the 18 years. So, so all of this that raises up all the votes, helps with the inflation, helps with the cost, helps folks build lives that can flourish.
Yeah. Now, as I've been talking about on the show, if every working person in this country was a member of a labor union, The vast majority of contracts I know have some cost of living adjustment stuff in it. I know my grandparents in the 70s, they saw 1975, my grandfather got three raises because inflation kept going up and wages kept going up to meet that, because, you know, you don't want your wages to be eroded. To me, this is one of the great talking points of why we should be joining and forming unions for all working people. And look, it's happening. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a lot of activity, which is why I'm also thrilled to hear the NLRB is moving back to the good old days of the Joy Silk Doctrine, to where if you sign a union card and you got the majority, you start bargaining. None of this nonsense of being harassed and intimidated and threatened and fired. You start negotiating. You start bargaining for better wages, hours, condition. Again, this is why I voted for Joe Biden and why I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, he's been a really strong leader on that.
So last question I've got for you. On the apprenticeship front, there are lots of opportunities. What should people do if they want to get their kids, my son wants to be an elevator mechanic. How do we get young people moving into those jobs?
Well, I know on our website there's where you can sign up if you're interested in things like that. And I'm going to guess that other, because I know your show is not confined to Maine, so I'm going to guess that other AFL-CIOs around the country on their websites probably have ways to get in touch too. But that is a great place to start asking the questions. Who's the union? How do I contact the union? There are pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs for all kinds of construction trades, elevator constructors, operating engineers, laborers, electricians, carpenters, bricklayers. You know, they all have strong apprenticeship programs. They all have strong wage benefit packages. And you can start with your AFL-CIO to ask how to contact that. Many of them also have building and construction trade councils. You want to make sure it's the building and construction trade councils, because those are the union organizations, not the, you know,
not the ABC people.
The non-union contractors. Yeah.
No. Don't waste your time in an ABC apprenticeship program where the vast majority of people don't finish and end up getting inferior training. Again, there's not a better bang for the buck.
Specify registered. Yeah. Registered apprenticeship. You look for registered apprenticeship, and then it'll meet your state standards and not just be something that calls itself apprenticeship.
There you go. Cynthia, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the great work. I look forward to talking to you again as we continue to expand the green energy universe. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Great to talk.
You as well. Cynthia Finney, president of the Maine AFL-CIO, maineaflcio.org, the website. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that workers at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota, went out on strike. They were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local P9. Hormel had slashed workers' wages by 23% during the early 1980s. Benefits were also diminished and incentive programs rolled back. These changes cut deeply into the Hormel workers' earnings. What had been considered a good job was changing drastically. This was the story for many workers in Reagan-era America. The 3,500 Hormel workers voted overwhelmingly to strike. The National UFCW discouraged the action. The strike lasted more than a year. Strikebreakers were brought in, including some of the union members who crossed the picket line to return to work. The National Guard was called in to keep the peace between strikers and the scabs. After a year, the strike went down in defeat. Even after the strike, many of the workers were not called back to work. They were put on waiting lists for a job to reopen. Some never returned to the plant.
25 years after the strike, the Austin Daily Herald staff wrote, quote, "What resulted was a bitter, drawn-out labor dispute that drastically impacted the community, from workers who lost their jobs to families that were torn apart by the picket lines." The strike became the feature of a documentary by Barbara Koppel. In 1990, the documentary American Dream won the Academy Award. The film tells the story of the Hormel strike as a window into the tragic experiences of many workers during the 1980s. The film was made on a shoestring budget. Singer Bruce Springsteen provided $25,000 to help support this important film.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email that caught my attention. And again, it's another one of these. Yesterday was just a big email day that there were so many of them that I wanted to get to. And if I didn't get to yours, there's always tomorrow or the next day. But I got an email that said, "Hey, Rick, I heard you talk about religious leaders and how they are losing their minds, and saw this story about Greg Locke smashing a Barbie house. Did you see it? Any thoughts?" And I didn't. She sent me this image of this pastor. One of the more famous right-wing zealoty kind of pastors, and he evidently wrapped a baseball bat with a Bible, and I'm not quite sure why. You know, it's one of those things where you're gonna use the Bible to bust up a Barbie house. Why? And evidently he spent time doing their show, whatever the song and dance is, you know, destroying this Barbie house. And again, you know, it's a movie, man. He's all worked up about a Barbie movie. And I guess it's because the Ken character acted a little feminine. I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, but I'm still trying to figure out why this matters that much. It's crazy. I mean, but I guess it's the time and the place in which we live in. But here's my another frustration. While we're distracted by this, while this is what someone writes me, and I appreciate it, thank you, we're still in a moment where our Republican leaders are doing nothing to help working families. And it used to be that Republicans were the party of the military. It used to be they were the party of national security, very paternalistic, the law and order types. And you do know that Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, is holding up the promotions of hundreds of military officers. And I guess we're three members short on the Joint Chief of Staff right now because Tuberville is holding all this stuff up. And Kyrsten Sinema, who I guess never finds a place where she doesn't want to butt her nose into, she decided today to call on the president and Tommy Tuberville to, you know, find common ground. You know, work this out. Find some common ground. Find the middle ground. This is why I hate Democrats sometimes. Or Kyrsten Sinema, more likely. Now remember, you know, Kyrsten was 100% prorated with Planned Parenthood and NARAL and all the abortion groups. But, you know, hey, you know, we have to find middle ground. And what middle ground got us was a ban on overturning Roe. So never mind that. But this is the question I have is, what does she want Joe Biden to do? Now, remember, she's got 100% rating from Planned Parenthood and these other groups, a 0% rating from the anti-abortion groups or the pro-birth groups. What common ground? What should Joe Biden concede to get Tuberville to do his job? This is my problem with weak Democrats, because there's nothing that drives me crazier than weak and stupid. And we've got both here. We've got Sinema, who's weak, and we've got Tuberville, who's stupid. And when weak and stupid are running your government, you've got problems. And we do. We've got problems. And this is why I keep saying the reason that working class voters have moved over to Republicans, even though Republican policies are horrible for them, are destroying their families, are destroying their jobs, destroying their communities. Even though they're doing all that, they at least look tough. They at least look strong. They at least look like they're fighting for something. Granted, they're fighting to screw me over. Granted, they're fighting to make sure my kids don't get an education, but they're fighting. And it's one of these things where you just go, what is it that's got you on there? It's angering and it's frustrating. But this is the place that we're in. Oh, we got Lewis online too. Let's go to Lewis. I got about a minute. Lewis, how are you, man?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Rick?
Good. What's on your mind? Go.
Since I'm short on time, I want to say that, you know, this discussion is really interesting. And I want to just kind of add a little something to the discussion about, you know, how to unify the working class. And, you know, the dominant narrative is one in which the Democrats lost the white working class because they went radically left and started social liberalism and stuff. But really what happened was the Democrats, you know, went along the lines of neoliberalism, and the working class, white or black, couldn't really make a distinction between the two parties, right? And in fact, everyone tends to think that it was Reagan that kick-started the neoliberalism.
No, it was Carter and Kennedy.
It was actually Carter.
And Kennedy.
I'm sorry?
It was Carter and Kennedy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, they were big on deregulation. And as you probably know, two of the major industries that Carter deregulated was
trucking and the airlines.
And, you know, trucking, right? So, you know, if the Democrats had stayed true to their original plan back a couple of decades ago,
we wouldn't be in this mess. You're spot on, Lewis. I appreciate the call, man. Thanks so much. Quick break.
No
right
problem.
Back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So earlier today, I was watching one of the, the TikTok, YouTube, one of them, one of the videos of a guy in Canada just railing against Justin Trudeau and how the mortgage rates are going through the roof and how, you know, people are going to get screwed out of their homes. And look, you know, these mortgage rates they're going up. And I don't know what we should and can be doing, which is why I thought it'd be a good idea to talk to our good friend Morris Pearl. He is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's great to be in your show, Rick. Thank you.
So have you been seeing these stories coming out of, you know, places like Canada? I haven't seen as much here as I saw there,
But
interest rates are going up. There's this concern that, you know, people are going to lose their homes and nobody's going to buy houses. And I know some hoping and wishing for recession. What are you seeing?
Well, I mean, people have got some valid concerns. Interest rates are now a lot higher than they were like a year ago. You know, interest rates have gone from, you know, below 3. If you could have taken out a mortgage a year ago with interest rate a little below 3. If you buy a house today, you're paying a little above 7 on your interest rate, probably. And that's a huge difference. That's a difference of like a payment of like $1,200 versus $2,000. And if you can afford to pay $1,200 a month for your mortgage, maybe you can't afford the $2,000 a month payment.
Right.
You know, and maybe you can't buy that house. So that's a problem for people.
But what do you say to the person, Morris, who goes, well, you know, at the end of the road, it doesn't matter. If the interest rates are higher, people aren't going to be able to pay the high prices. So the prices are going to have to come down. And at the end, it all comes out in the wash anyway. What do you say to that argument?
Well, to a large extent, I believe it. For house, you know, in area where people get mortgages, if for the multi-million dollar house that people pay cash for, it doesn't apply. But for the $500,000 houses and $200,000 houses that people get mortgages for, yeah, when you go to look for a house, the broker is going to ask you about how much money you make and check your credit score, and they're going to figure out what kind of mortgage you can qualify for. And if they say, okay, you're going to qualify for a mortgage You can pay, you know, $1,300 a month based on your salary. You qualify for a mortgage of this much. That's how much you can afford to pay for the house. And if everybody's in the same boat, well, if the guy wants to sell the house, that's what he's going to get for it.
Yeah.
And interest rates are going up for everybody pretty much. So I kind of believe that argument to an extent. When rates go up, that's bad for house prices. But an additional thing that's happening now is that so many of these guys who are, own houses do have mortgages of like 3%. Mortgages were below 4% for a couple of years. And so their thing, well, I could downsize. But if I downsize, I'm going to have to get a 7% mortgage on this smaller place and pay even more. So why bother? And so a lot of people, they're just saying, sorry, I can't afford to move. So a lot fewer houses are for sale right now. And people are, you know, there's less houses available. And so those few that are available, because somebody really has to move, you know, they have to move to a different part of the country, or, you know, their spouse died or something, those people are able to hold out for higher prices. But that's, I think, if mortgage rates continue to go up, house prices will kind of go down to correspond to that. You know, I'm 63. I remember, you know, the 1980s when mortgage rates were above 12 for 5 years in a row, you know?
No, I had a relative that I spoke with earlier who said the same thing. They bought their house back in the early 80s. Their mortgage was 12%. And he said, you know, like, you wrote most of that off. He goes, but the reality is that our wages were sufficiently high enough to cover that. That as inflation went up, our wages went up because you had cost of living adjustments and union contracts. So it didn't hurt as bad as it's hurting working people today, because wages haven't kept up with inflation over the last 40 years.
No, they haven't. But wages are starting to catch up now. That's really what drives me crazy. I read the Fed minutes that came out, I think it was yesterday. You know, they're concerned, oh, wages are continuing to go up. We have to get them back in line with their historical norms of percentage of profits and things like that. It's like, I can't stand this.
Yeah, but at what period in history are you talking about? You know, when I started
working... Yesterday.
I go back to, you know, the late 80s when I started working, and the job that I currently do, I started off making $15 an hour, top rate a little bit over 80, over 18. Right now, that same job starts off at 21, not 15. And we're talking 35 years later, a very small increase. Wages have not kept up historically. If we could go back to the way the wage structure was in the late 80s, I wouldn't be unhappy with that.
Well, I just meant things have improved since like 6 months ago, 9 months ago. You know, a few more places are getting unionized. The UPS people got a contract with the Teamsters. Starbucks is getting unionized here and there. Amazon is paying more. Over the last 6-9 months, things seem to be looking a little bit better for the working people. That's all I'm saying.
No, you're right. So I know a lot of people are blaming Biden for this mess. Is this his fault?
I don't think it's his fault. He could get the people in the Fed to not raise interest rates as much and not worry about inflation so much. But that is kind of their job, to worry about inflation.
Does he have the power to do that?
Like inflation. Well, he does appoint them. And presumably he tries to appoint people that like him, I would think. So he might have some influence on them. But no, not, he doesn't have direct power to control the Fed. They're independent once they're appointed. He's trying to like do things like forgive student loans, provide more money, you know, in infrastructure projects so more people have jobs. So putting more money in people's pockets, that's what he can do, or what Congress and the president together can do to do this. Now, of course, some people don't like the idea of student loans being forgiven. Some people don't like the idea of the federal government paying for more roads and bridges and stuff like that.
Right, but Congress isn't going to do any of that stuff. Because we've got a divided Congress. And look, how is he going to have any influence over the Fed? You know, Jerome Powell was put in place by Trump.
Well, that's true. That is true.
So
I mean, Jerome Powell, I think he's a reasonable guy. He's really afraid of inflation. And he's afraid of, like, you know, taking his hands off the controls and then suddenly seeing inflation spike up again. And then say, oh, my God, this guy's a complete idiot. So, you know, he's a little scared, I think. But I'm hoping that they'll decide that having the economy growing is actually a good thing, even if that does cause some inflation. They do have a dual mandate, high employment and low inflation at the same time.
Well, how do you do that? And I've always wondered that. Even, you know, back when I was taking Econ 101 1,000 years ago, I still wonder, how do you have this dual job where one affects the other? If you have low inflation, the way of getting inflation down is to cause more unemployment. How do you juggle that? If you have full employment and everyone has jobs, a tighter labor market, wages, you know, just or how is explained by the X graphs, wages go up. How do you balance
that? Yeah. And we think that's good if labor markets are tight and wages are going up and unions are negotiating better contracts. I think that's a good thing. And yes, it does cause inflation. If everybody in your town gets a raise, chances are the guy at the bar is going to be raising the prices of the beer. Chances are the guy who owns the apartment building is going to be doing leases for higher rates next year. Yeah, if you have more money, you can pay people. People will increase the price of things too. But hopefully, the people can get raises more than the amount that prices are going up. And sometimes that's working.
But here's how it was explained to me. And you know, again, I'm going back to what 1,000 years ago of economic, the economic class I took. You know, as long as inflation is under what wage increases you've got, that's a good thing, especially for working people, especially for people in debt. If your wages are just above inflation, your life is better. You're having a better standard of living. But we've been under that water for a while. And that's why I think you see the anger and the frustration a lot of working people have.
Well, inflation is actually could be a helpful thing if you have a huge mortgage.
Yeah.
Your mortgage, if you own a house with a big mortgage, the mortgage is the one thing that does not go up with inflation. If you're in a rental, then you're in trouble. If you have a lot of cash in your bank account, well, you can buy less stuff when prices go up. So it's bad for people with a lot of cash. Good for people with a lot of debt. There was a time when people ran for office with the idea that we're going to have more inflation. It's a good thing, you know, particularly in the farming areas where the farmers had huge mortgages.
Right. And this is why the reason I'm going in this direction is my grandparents, they bought their house in the late 60s. And by the late 70s, their mortgage was a day's pay. Inflation had gone up that much to where the home that they bought that they were struggling to pay in the 60s was an absolute joke by the late 70s. I don't ever see that happening today for working people, but I don't think a little bit of inflation is bad.
It will. It can. If inflation is a few percent per year for 30 years, yeah. And if you can get a 7% mortgage now on a home, and if the inflation goes up, both wages and house prices, 3 or 4% or 5% for 30 years, that mortgage is going to look like a joke 29 years from now.
Yeah.
And the guy's going to feel brilliant when he sells his house for $1 million and is making a couple hundred bucks in mortgage payments.
No.
So you have to, over the long term, those things work. Over the short term, they don't. You know, your parents are probably felt pretty stupid 3 months after they bought the house, when they were kind of having to budget, you know, how much to spend on food. But 20 years after that, they felt brilliant. So,
no, it's a good point. And also the fact is at that time, you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, you know, CD rates and saving rates were much higher than they are now. And I'm not seeing that same dynamic. So I think this is another reason people are frustrated with bankers and banks, because they feel like they're being gouged.
Well, what happened in the 1970s, people started taking all their money out of the banks and buying government bonds that were paying like 12%. That's when the banks started raising interest rates. That was essentially when money market funds were invented, was in the mid-1970s. So I think people are starting to take their money out of banks now and putting it into other things. You can get government bonds that pay around 6.5-7%. Government guaranteed,
yeah.
You know, mortgage-backed securities that pay 6.5%. You can buy them.
Yeah, I got one last year for 10%.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, last line of questioning I've got for you on this topic, where do you see things going? I mean, because that's the big question. Are we creating an environment where, you know, the real estate industry is going to go bust? Do we see a boom coming? What are we seeing?
I'm hoping what we're seeing is things just kind of staying the way they are for a while. Prices not going up too much, wages going up slowly, and people living happily thereafter. You know, I think I choose to be an optimist. I think, you know, more workers are demanding higher pay, and I think they're getting it in some cases, like the Teamsters and the UPS. And I think that we're seeing inflation dying down. I think it mostly came because of supply chain issues, of shortages of stuff, and people raising the prices of when they were short of stuff. And these, you know, people like Chipotle saying, oh, well, now there's no more shortage, but we're leaving the prices where they are, and people are still paying, and we're making enormously higher profits. I think eventually that will go away, and prices will kind of remain constant for a while. So I choose to be an optimist, Rick.
I want to share your optimism. I do. But we'll see how it plays out. But as always, Morris, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
You as well, our good friend Morris Pearl. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you happy where we are? Or are you kind of a little tentative like I am? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A couple of emails questioning my position on Kyrsten Sinema. Evidently, some folks in Arizona, some fans of Kyrsten. I can't imagine there are many. The polling not doing well for her. But questioning, you know, my questioning her being involved. You know, she's a U.S. senator. I get that. How about you're a U.S. senator? You go to him and say, hey, this is stupid. Let's fight a different battle. But this is, as I said, you know, weak and stupid. That makes me crazy. And you have both here. Sinema's weak and Tuberville's stupid. And what you have then is this, well, we got to find compromise. And I don't know what that compromise is other than Biden surrendering something. Other than Biden, you know, caving, which Republicans know Democrats will do. I mean, one of the things that I remember Dick Cheney saying, there was an issue in front of them and they go, oh, the Democrats will cave. It's what they do because of this idea of compromise. And as I said a moment ago, the reason a lot of working class voters have turned to the Republican Party is they look at Democrats as weak. They look at Democrats as, which is why, you know, when we go out and we talk to people, people go to me, well, you can't be a Democrat, because I don't back down from my beliefs. I don't back down from my true north. And I will stand and argue until the cows come home, because I'm passionate about what I believe. And they don't necessarily, the people that I know don't believe that Democrats think that way, because they are willing to compromise. And understand, it's because they're not willing to tear the country apart. They're not willing to destroy the house. Whereas a lot of my Republican friends are, you burn it down. Yeah, we'll burn down the house. And this is what Tuberville's willing to do. To get his pound of flesh, he's willing to put the country in peril. He's willing to allow the military to go rudderless for a while. He's willing to have not the full complement of chief justices, not willing to get the promotions and people into the positions on the military that need to be. Now, remember, as we've said in the past, you know, our internal fights, you know, the way it's always framed is, you know, we're siblings, you know, we're going to pound the heck out of each other. We're going to beat each other up. We're going to humiliate each other. We're going to call each other names. But outside the borders, you better not. It's like my kids tear into each other constantly. But if somebody else goes after one or the other, they're unified. You don't talk to my sibling like that. And that's kind of how this country, I always thought this country was. Now, we may not agree. We may fight like, you know, cats and dogs. But when it comes to the water's edge, we're united. So to have something like this go on as long as it's gone on is quite distressing. And then to have cinema come and go, you know, you need to find a common ground, compromise. Here's the common ground. Do your job, dumb guy. Do your job. Put those people where they belong. Make your stand on something else. Because the pound of flesh is, what he wants is, you know, we're going to ban care for women in the military. That's his pound of flesh. Now, it goes back to what I've always said about, you know, how Democrats and Republicans operate. You know, Republicans always, you know, they want what they want and they stand on that. So they come, like any negotiation, everybody has their wish list. But they come and say, well, look, we want both your legs. Got to have both legs. And you got Democrats saying, no, we need both our legs. No, got to have both of them. Got to have them both. How about just one? And they take one leg 6 months later and go, you know, we need the other one. We need the other leg. How about just to the knee? You know, and eventually they get what they want by holding the country hostage. So this idea that, you know, well, we're gonna compromise. There are some things you don't. Now, there's common ground on a lot of things, but there are some things that are a matter of principle. Now, you can say, hey, you know, that's what Tuberville's doing too. And it is. He's taking a principled stance, you could argue. The question then becomes, as a country, as a voter, are you okay with that? And this is why we have elections, to throw the bums out. Because poll after poll shows the vast majority of people are on the other side of Tuberville. It's frustrating and it's angering where we are. But it is what it is. You want to talk about something else that's frustrating? Now, I'm still stuck on this thing with Tuberville. I got to tell you. You know, I'm not a military person. I as an institution, I struggle with having such a large military and the funding and the expenditures and the money that we spend on it. We could spend it in a lot of other places. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about, we're going to hold the people who do all the fighting and dying and bleeding, we're going to hold them hostage. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the fact that we haven't taken care of our veterans, that we haven't done the things that we said we were going to do. I have a problem that we've allowed another war to happen, and people who actually make the sacrifice are the ones who are held out to dry. This is my problem with Tuberville, and he has brought out all of that in me. The fact that this is the stand that he has chosen to make. is quite infuriating. And I hope the people in Alabama take this to heart. I hope the people in Alabama understand what he is doing, not just to our military at home, but abroad. This showing a sense of weakness, this showing a sense of division, this showing the world that we can't do the simplest thing without there being red hat, blue hat. It shows weakness. And I'm sorry, I don't see what the compromise is. I don't see where Christian cinema is coming from. I don't see where what Joe Biden can do. And it's a lot of this stuff. I don't see what Biden can do in a lot of these scenarios that are out of his control. But I guess the narrative is that we can blame him for everything. And look, he's president. He deserves to be blamed for everything. But we've got to be smart enough to know what he's actually to be held accountable for and what not. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Again, it's the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. We're going to find out what that's doing on the green front. Back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act, and look, inflation's coming down. That is a good thing. Drug prices a little bit coming down, especially on insulin. That's a good thing. But more importantly, we're cleaning and greening our economy, and that is a great thing. And here to bring the class war wonk, I've asked Ben Beachy to come talk with us. He's Vice President of Industrial Policy at the Blue-Green Alliance. BlueGreenAlliance.org, the website. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here.
So the one-year anniversary of a bill I never thought was actually going to happen, but some really good stuff coming out of this, isn't there?
Yeah. It's a really historic wave of federal funding to transform our economy. Not only is it the largest climate investment in U.S. history, it's also one of the biggest investments in revitalizing manufacturing in this country, and creating access to higher paying jobs for millions of people, and investing in communities who have seen decades of divestment. So it has the potential to be a real win-win-win for climate, for jobs, and for justice.
I've been saying for a while that, you know, the way we rebuild our economy is you have to start with an industrial policy, which we haven't had for a very long time because we've believed in the invisible hand and, some magical, mythical thinking. But this is actually a policy to move us in two good directions. One, the jobs from manufacturing, as you point out, but getting us somewhat off the dirty stuff into more clean, green energy. I don't see a downside.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? We're already starting to see some results here, even before the spigot of funding has fully opened. You know, President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act just 1 year ago. And already in that time, we've seen companies announce a wave of clean energy and clean manufacturing investments that are projected to create more than 170,000 jobs across 44 states. You know, that's faster than anyone predicted. And as the programs get stood up and the federal funds start to flow, those investments will only increase, as will the job creation. And I think it's important here to zoom in on manufacturing, just because, as you named, industrial policy was like a dirty word during decades of neoliberalism. But it's back. It's back. And we right now are intentionally using all of the levers available to us, including the levers of government, to grow sectors of the economy that are strategically imperative for a cleaner, more prosperous, and more equitable economy, right? And so that includes manufacturing. So in just the last year, manufacturers have announced 83 new or expanded clean energy manufacturing facilities, right? These are the facilities that are going to make the widgets for solar, for wind, for batteries, for our clean energy future. And that is critical because it shows that, you know, we need not hitch our climate goals to vulnerable overseas supply chains that are marred by labor abuses and higher levels of pollution, you know, shipping bottlenecks. Instead, with these investments, we have an opportunity to build our clean energy future on a foundation of good jobs, more reliable supply chains, and clean manufacturing. Yep. That was always the right thing to do. Now it's the most economical thing to do.
No, and look, this is one of the things I give Joe Biden the most credit for, that they're moving away from decades-old bad policy and moving us back to some good policy ideas. Because, look, you know, I just went to see the movie Oppenheimer. And this is one of those things that, you know, it popped into my head the other day. You know, I was watching the movie and what's his name? Matt Damon's character was talking to, you know, the other character. He goes, whatever you need. The guy goes, build me a town. They built him a town. Whatever they needed to get that project done, the Manhattan Project done, they did it because they said, we're going to do this and we're going to do it no matter what. So for me, the idea of a Manhattan type project, you know, in green energy or industrial policy is appealing because it says, as a country, we're all united in going this direction. And I think we need to get there.
Yeah. I mean, look, my simplest defense of industrial policy is when one has a goal, it is helpful to have a plan, right? I mean, for years, we have been outsourcing plans to corporate boardrooms. And now for once, you know, we the people are taking back the plan. And that involves transforming our economy. One additional element that I want to name, I mentioned climate and jobs and justice, just to drill down on the justice element, right? These investments are a really rare opportunity to invest in communities that have endured, you know, decades of divestment, right? Communities hollowed out by unfair trade deals, communities excluded by racist practices like redlining, communities that are right now enduring shifts in energy, right? The energy transition we're going through. Communities that have been harmed by environmental injustice. Right now, we have the opportunity to tie strong equity and labor and environmental standards to all this funding that's going out the door so as to equip these hard-hit communities to translate these federal investments into higher-paying jobs, cleaner air, stronger local economies, right? That's the opportunity we face. It's not just to transform how we power our economy, but how power is distributed among our communities.
No, that's an excellent way to put it. But for me, it's sound policy, smart investment. That's the way forward. Now, you talked about private money going into building all this stuff. And that's what happens when you have public dollars going in that direction, which is why I've always said I'm a big supporter of public-private partnerships, as long as they operate in the way of using public dollars to get a public outcome using private interests, not ensuring that private interests get public dollars for themselves. And I think there's a distinction there.
That's absolutely right. Right. I mean, here, what we're doing is, you know, leveraging the power of public dollars to spur a sea change in how private dollars also flow. Right. You know, private dollars need to be guided. We are guiding them now. We are guiding them towards wind and solar power, but also wind and solar manufacturing. We're guiding them towards, electric vehicles and also electric vehicle manufacturing. We're guiding them towards retrofits of our homes and offices to make them cleaner, more efficient, and healthier. Right? These are things that were always the right thing to do. But the corporate boardrooms alone were not going to do it. They needed some guidance. And right now, what you see is basically a $2 trillion guidance.
Or you could look at it a different way. There's one way to herd cats, and that's put out a little food. Put out the food dish, and they will come. And look, the $2 trillion, that's an incentive to move in a direction and to bring those jobs back. Now, I got to tell you, I hate the idea that we're funding corporate America to do the right thing, but we're in a moment where I don't know that there's any other way for this to happen. Or do you see any other way than the path that we've taken?
look, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. This is not the only one. But I do think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Those investments that I just named at the outset, right? Those are all private investments, right? And those private investments will matter to folks on the ground if we get the details right, who are going to be able to take good, high paying jobs, often jobs that are accessible to folks without a bachelor's degree. These are investments that will clean up the air in communities that have seen, decades of toxic pollution. These are investments that will, invest in the local tax revenue of communities like mine and Central West Virginia, like communities across the country that have been, harmed by, like I said, unfair economic policies, unfair trade deals, energy transition, and a lot. So, yes, it's true that a lot of this is public dollars guiding private investments. But if we get the details right, if we tie those investments to labor standards, to equity standards, they can make a real difference for folks on the ground.
Now, you mentioned your former state of West Virginia. Joe Manchin, the senator from there, vowed just, I think it was just yesterday, in fact, that he was going to fight the radical climate agenda. Seems a curious time on the first anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act that is going to take a step in dealing with our climate issues. Seems an interesting time to be throwing that out of fighting the radical agenda.
Yeah. I don't even begin to suggest that I have a sense of what Joe Manchin is thinking at any given time. So I think I'll let that one be.
No, but the reason I bring this up is because, look, West Virginia is an energy state. This is a perfect place. And you mentioned, going into places that have been left behind, that have been left out in the past, that have suffered from deindustrialization or moving away from certain things such as coal. This is an opportunity to fill those voids. I mean, last October and in November, we did a multi-state tour where we went to places that used to be all those faces, places that had factories that were the identity of that community or just been wiped out. This is an opportunity to fill that void.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we cannot leave workers or communities behind as we take essential climate action, right? For too many times in our history, we've assumed that technology shifts will just naturally bring workers and communities along, right? Like that is just an automatic thing. This law rightly recognizes that an energy transition that is actually fair for workers and for communities needs to be a deliberate policy choice. Right. So as one example, there's one of the programs has about $10 billion in it to manufacture more wind and solar components, right? Creating good, typically high paying jobs, often union jobs. And $4 billion of that 10 is set aside for coal communities. $4 billion. And it's not just incentivized, it's actually set aside. So that's a healthy degree of investment that's going to be going into coal communities. These are communities that have seen recent closures of either a coal mine or a coal-fired power plant. They qualify. So that's a strong incentive, right, for anyone who's trying to set up a manufacturing facility to invest in places like West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky and Wyoming, other places around the U.S. that have seen coal closures. So it's, that's one example of several that are in the law to try to make a fair transition a deliberate policy choice.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because here's the thing. You said that we assume that the workers are going to be brought along. I never assume that because right. I can't find a technological advancement that workers didn't take it on the chin in the frictional state of it being implemented. It's the same thing I fear with automation and robotics. I fear workers are going to end up being on the short end of this stick. This policy, and I'm glad you pointed it out, this Inflation Reduction Act is actually taking that into mind and trying to alleviate that problem. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, I know a lot of us really fought hard for that and really care about it.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, like any policy, we're just a year into this. Not all the money's been rolled out. I don't know that it's all been promised. What are we looking for in the next year? I mean, how does this rollout happen? What should we be paying attention to?
Yeah. So like I said, the spigot is just barely open, right? The funding is going to really start flowing in the next year. And I think, we actually commissioned a study to ask this question, like what can we anticipate? And we zoomed in on wind and solar. So maybe I'll just use that as an example, right? One of the things that they found is that just one of the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act is going to make it cheaper to manufacture wind and solar components in the United States than to import them for the first time in U.S. history, right? So that's just it's a game changer for clean energy manufacturing, right? Again, we have the opportunity to build cleaner, stronger, fairer supply chains for clean energy here. And that they estimate not only is it going to make it cheaper, but that means more investment, which means more jobs. And they estimated that it will create about 1.6 million jobs by 2035, and a number of jobs leading up to that, and that about 800,000 of those are in manufacturing, right? So it's like, you know, these are real numbers, folks. Like that is a sea change relative to the status quo. Another thing, just to name that study looked at was for not the manufacturing jobs, but the folks who are working to deploy the wind and solar power, working on construction, right? For the first time, it pays to pay workers well. That is, like, wind and solar companies can cut their costs by 60% if they pay prevailing wages and use apprenticeship programs to offer career pathways. And that's thanks to the structure of this Inflation Reduction Act. So again, real opportunities, if we get the details right, for climate, for jobs, and for justice.
No, and look, you know, for me, it's another reason why 2024 is so important politically, so that we don't end up going back on those, on this bill and on these investments. Again, another political time. But Ben, I appreciate you taking a little time, sharing some information. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
Good stuff, Ben Beachy. He is the he's the vice president of industrial policy there at the Blue Green Alliance. Check out their website, bluegreenalliance.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. A quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that 101 leaders of the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, were convicted in Chicago federal court. Their alleged crime? Violating the Espionage Act during World War I by calling strikes in war industries and calling for an end to the draft. Those convicted included some of the leading names of the IWW. Big Bill Haywood, Ralph Chaplin, the author of Solidarity Forever, and Ben Fletcher, a black IWW organizer in Louisiana, were all found guilty. More IWW leaders awaited trial in California and Kansas. Federal raids swept up Wobbly leaders across the country. In all, more than 2,000 IWW members were arrested during the war. Kenesaw Mountain Landis presided as judge over the Chicago trial. In Chicago, the jury deliberated only a little more than an hour. They found every defendant guilty. Landis sentenced Big Bill Haywood and other top IWW leaders with 20 years in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. Ben Fletcher got 5 years. All of the men went to prison, except Haywood, who skipped bail and fled the country. The arrests and convictions were a devastating blow to the IWW. But the union did not completely disappear. New leaders emerged to carry on their mission of one big union. Their headquarters are still located in Chicago. President Calvin Coolidge commuted the sentences of those still in prison in 1923. As for Judge Landis, his action on being tough on so-called Reds earned him a national reputation. And so, in 1920, he became Major League Baseball's first commissioner, a post he would hold for more than two decades. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, this is one of those moments. Have you noticed that you don't hear much about Jim Jordan anymore? You know, seems like nobody cares about Jim Jordan anymore, or Bobo for that interest, for that matter. I haven't heard much about Gun Fetish Barbie or Marjorie Three Names. Been kind of quiet on the crazy front. And I don't know if that's just the mainstream media just kind of taking a break, or they're just not producing fresh, crazy content. I don't know. But how many people saw that Jim Jordan's committee, the House Judiciary Committee, subpoenaed Merrick Garland and Christopher Wray, the FBI director? I didn't, you know, it was a small little story I saw. Wasn't a big deal. I know, the weaponization. They're weaponizing the government against poor, pitiful Donnie. Have you noticed something with the persecution of Donald Trump? Have you noticed that none of the people who are witnesses, none of the people who are involved are actually Democrats? Have you noticed that it's all Republicans? Somehow, Joe Biden has weaponized the Republican Party against themselves. It's crazy. It is literally crazy. Now, I look at what's going on down in Georgia. And you've got a state, I think it's a state senator, who's now looking into going after Fannie Willis because, you know, she's weaponized. They published the names of the jurors, the grand jurors, who were the ones who set down the indictment. And now you've got the Fulton County Sheriff's Department that are investigating threats against these jurors. And this is one of those things where there's part of me that goes, why do we publish the names of these grand jurors? Because you knew that you know, crazy people are going to threaten them. And look, there are lunatics on all sides of the politics. But, you know, this promoting of violence that we see is crazy. For instance, in my neck of the woods, evidently, you know, some old woman was all angry, 69-year-old woman, charged with arson and other related crimes, when she set three fires to the home of the mayor in her town. I guess she really didn't like that decision that the mayor made. And this is one of these things where you go, explain to me why you would take this kind of action. Now, you know, crazy, you know, off the deep end, folks. For instance, also, you know, a woman with dual citizenship in France and Canada was in Canada, sent ricin, I believe it was, to Donald Trump and eight Texas law enforcement officers. Now, again, I condemn all of it. This is stupid. It's terrible. She had 22 years in jail. So my mind goes, here's the baseline. 22 years in jail for sending ricin to Trump and to others. Okay. If you're threatening someone's life, if you're doing all this stuff, pretty good place. So all of you crazy people who are going to threaten these grand jury folks, there's the bar. Is it worth it? You look at what happened out in Utah, and I know my crazy right-wing friends are, we've never killed anybody when the FBI comes to their door. Really? you point a gun at an FBI agent, they're going to shoot you. And this is where the MAGA folks have kind of be worried, because they've all got arsenals, and people know they've got arsenals. So don't make threats against people. Don't do it. And it's so bad. It's so bad that the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, and I didn't even know there was a group called the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State. Evidently, they have started a tax-exempt 501c4 organization called Value the Vote in five states, Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, Nevada, Wisconsin, with one of the sole purposes to protect election officers, to protect the officials who, you know, take care of that show up for election day. Evidently, they've raised $2.5 million of the $10 million that they need. But this is, are you kidding me? They're raising money to pay private security for election officials of both parties, because, you know, crazy doesn't know any bounds. There seem to be a lot of red hat crazy, though. And they're going to evidently protect those folks and then register new voters and try and combat disinformation. And I'm going, $10 million? That's all you're going to, that's all, you think you're going to do all that with $10 million bucks? It's crazy where we are, isn't it? And I'll tell you, you know, 20 years ago, you know, I knew things were getting heated. I knew we were You know, we were a little tense. Never would imagine where we are today. Never imagine how mean we are to each other, how hateful and spiteful that you see people, especially people who view the others. And I'm of the mindset of, you know, how do we organize people to come back together, get between the curbs and hammer out what are real problems? Because as I started today's show off on, you know, that Anthony Oliver, or Oliver Anthony is his name, the guy with the Richmond song, he's hit a nerve that working people need to understand. And he's got a story. He's authentic. He's a real guy who's suffering real consequences. The question is will we take this moment and come together, or will we use this as another thing to divide us? Will this be the thing that can draw us together? Will this be the spark? Can it be? Because at the end of the day, if we start focusing on the right things, like the reasons that our education system is failing, the reason that our cities are crumbling, our rural communities are struggling, if we focused on the real problems and said, hey, let's fix those, and we focused on the reason why we're in the situation we're in, you know, the rich people ain't going to be very happy. Because you talk to people, they want a higher tax code for the very wealthy. They believe they're taxed enough already. They're struggling to put food on the table. When we start focused on the right things, I think we can do great things. But as long as we're continually at each other's throats, red hat, blue hat ain't going to make it. Want to hear your thoughts, though. Miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you can find ours. Email me. If something I said got under your skin, on your nerves, made you happy, made you sad, by all means, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Appreciate you taking some time to tune in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.